regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court's Wolford versus Lopez case. This is the first of, so far, two Second Amendment cases that the court has decided to hear this term. Oral arguments are coming up in January 20th, I believe. And this is the case that deals with Hawaii's default rule that bans concealed carry on all private property, including property open to the public, unless the property owner explicitly gives permission for folks to carry. That basically flips the script on what the law is in the vast majority of states where concealed carry is presumed to be okay. And if you're a property owner who doesn't want to allow that, then you post signage to that effect. Hawaii's law is relatively recent. It was one of the post-Bruin laws that Hawaii adopted after it was told that it could no longer have its May-issue concealed carry system. So the lawmakers in Hawaii decided, all right, since we can't stop everybody from getting a concealed carry permit, we're going to stop everybody from carrying almost everywhere in the state of Hawaii. In addition to the default rule, or the vampire rule, as Foreign Policy Coalition's Rob Romano coined the ban, Hawaii, I believe, has 15 other places that are deemed sensitive where guns are banned. But the default rule would apply to almost every one of those locations as well. Those other sensitive places are not being challenged in Wolford versus Lopez, but the vampire rule is. And on Monday, we saw almost 20 briefs filed in support of the plaintiffs in this case. There were a couple of amicus briefs that were filed late last week, but more than a dozen dropped yesterday, including one filed by the Department of Justice, the first time in history that the Department of Justice has filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court, siding with the plaintiffs in a challenge to a gun law. So that's great to see. I wrote about the brief, which was very well done, at Bearing Arms. But I thought on the program today, we'd take a look at one of the other 21 amicus briefs that have been filed in total. This one filed by the states of Idaho, Montana, and 23 other states. I guess we can go through them all if we need to. But states of Montana, Idaho, Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, West Virginia, Wyoming, and the Arizona legislature. I'm not sure, by the way, why Virginia Attorney General Jason Meares did not join onto this brief. God knows that Jay Jones, the incoming Democrat Attorney General, is not going to be signing on any pro-gun briefs, but it's disappointing that Meares, the Republican Attorney General of Virginia, not a part of this brief, arguing that Hawaii's vampire rule is unconstitutional and an infringement of our Second Amendment rights. I just say that as a Virginia resident. So let's go through the brief. You know, the purpose of these amici briefs is to buttress the main arguments that are presented by the plaintiffs. So, you know, you will often find briefs sharing similar arguments. I mean, they're really, if you think about it, there probably aren't 21 different ways to argue against Hawaii's vampire rule. But, you know, every amicus brings something unique to the table, right? They're representing their interests. And so in this case, you've got 25 attorneys general who are arguing that Hawaii's law is not only a violation of the Second Amendment, but if it is allowed to stand, that future court rulings citing Wolford could impact the Second Amendment rights of residents in their states. So as the brief states, instead of acting to secure the Second Amendment rights guaranteed to citizens as affirmed by Bruin, Hawaii's enactment of Act 52 illustrates the state entrenched hostility to these rights. State laws enacted in recent years, along with state court decisions, demonstrate that the state of Hawaii has decided there's no room for an individual right to bear arms within its so-called spirit of aloha. Unfortunately, it's not alone. Several lower court rulings also have largely failed to follow through on Bruin's promise by resorting to manipulative on-bank practices, ahistorical interpretations of covered arms, and improperly calibrating the level of generality for Bruin's inquiry. So while the amicus brief primarily deals with the vampire rule itself, these attorney generals do note that this is an opportunity for the court to rein in some of the abuses that we've seen at the district court level, at the appellate court level. And again, those abuses are going to continue until the Supreme Court calls them out and explicitly says, no, you can't do this. So the plaintiffs, go on to say the rights embedded in the Constitution generally protect against state action, not private action. This means that Hawaii cannot prohibit its citizens from bearing arms in public, but private property owners are generally free to do so within the boundaries of their property. Hawaii's Act 52 flipped this presumption. The law prohibits a person from carrying a firearm on privately held property unless the owner has given express authorization that carrying or possessing a firearm is authorized through either unambiguous written or verbal authorization or the posting of clear and conspicuous signage at the entrance of the building or on the premises. By changing the default rule that citizens may exercise their constitutional rights and decreeing that firearms are prohibited on private property unless the owner expressly consents in advance, Hawaii co-opts the owner's power to restrict Hawaii's exercise of their right to bear arms. The Ninth Circuit failed to recognize how deeply problematic this rule is and relied on inopposite outlier regulations to justify its reversal of the injunction below. That's right, there was an injunction granted on the vampire rule by a district court judge, but that was reversed by the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit, oddly enough, found that California's vampire rule was actually a violation of the Second Amendment. It's very, very similar to Hawaii's. But again, different rulings from, a different panel of judges. The attorneys general go on to note that the Second Amendment is not the only constitutional right that property owners can interfere with. They can restrict speech on their property or association or religious exercise. And unless they are public accommodations, they can exclude people on the basis of race, sex, or another protected characteristic. But in any of those contexts, a law like Hawaii's would be unconstitutional. Imagine an anti-abortion state banning abortion discussions on private property without the owner's prior express consent. Or imagine a state requiring express consent before visitors to a property could pray or read White Fragility or hold hands with a same-sex spouse. No doubt, the owners could overrule the state and tell visitors that the forbidden conduct was permitted, but most visitors to stores and restaurants and such would never ask. Compliance with the state's unconstitutional wishes would be easier. And again, we get back to the powers that the state has. If a state assumed that power to restrict speech on private property unless the property owner expressly said otherwise, I think these attorney generals are right. I mean, people would lose their minds over this. So it's a really good analogy to take it out of the Second Amendment context and to put it into the First Amendment context, because we have been told by the Supreme Court that the Second Amendment is not a second-class right. So if we're going to view the Second Amendment like we would the First Amendment and those freedoms that are guaranteed by the First Amendment, it really does, I think, just highlight how ridiculous Hawaii's default rule is here. Now, they get into the Ninth Circuit's rationale in upholding the vampire rule. And they say, well, the court rightly discounted a smattering of anti-poaching laws as part of a national tradition. The Ninth Circuit upheld the law on the basis of two historical regulations, a 1771 New Jersey law and an 1865 Louisiana law. The court found that these laws purportedly banned the carrying of firearms on any private property without the owner's consent, just like Hawaii's law. And that was enough for the court to reverse the district's court injunction. In fact, they called these two laws dead ringers. Now, I would argue that two statutes written nearly 100 years apart does not constitute a national tradition of gun ownership. You need more than two statutes. The first one, the New Jersey statute, written in 1771. The Louisiana statute, written in 1865. So again, even in 1771, New Jersey's law was an outlier. In 1865, Louisiana's law was an outlier. So how can those two laws combined suddenly amount to a national tradition of banning concealed carry or banning carry of firearms by default on all private property? The attorneys general also note that these laws are not, in fact, dead ringers to Hawaii's law. And we've talked about this before on the program. The New Jersey law essentially banned the carrying of firearms on improved property, property for which the owner was paying taxes. But if somebody had, let's say, you know, again, a 1,600-acre farm, and they had cut down the trees, they had tilled the land on 800 of those acres, but the other 800 acres were wild, they were untouched. That 1771 law prohibited someone from carrying onto the property that was actively being worked as a farm. But that unimproved land, you could still carry on that privately owned property. The 1865 law, which was part of the Black Codes, disturbingly sad part of American history, where the Louisiana government did not want to acknowledge that the Civil War was over, that freed slaves were in fact free and had all of the rights of American citizens, was written in a sort of racially neutral sense, but it was applied in very much a racially non-neutral sense. It too prohibited carrying of firearms onto some private property, specifically plantations, but it did not prohibit carrying of firearms onto all private property. So again, these aren't dead ringers, as the Ninth Circuit asserted. As the AGs say, these are merely two isolated examples that do not even expressly relate to private lands open to the public. They were enacted nearly 100 years apart by states with a tiny portion of the national population. The evidence is, quote, surely too slender a reed on which to hang a historical tradition of restricting the right to carry, quoting the Bruin decision. And as the AGs say, the Ninth Circuit just ignored those issues. After skipping most of the inquiry that Bruin demanded, the court erroneously found that the historical regulations are not just relevantly similar to Hawaii's law, but that they were dead ringers. And with this, the court found an established historical tradition directly at odds with the text of the Second Amendment and upheld the law. The findings, they say, are straight from Wonderland. And then they go ahead and quote Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, where Alice is talking, I believe, to the Mad Hatter. No, to Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty says, when I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be master. That's all. In other words, the Ninth Circuit says so, and that's what we should just accept. Well, no. As the Attorney General writes, the court should reject this latest attempt to disregard its precedent to give a critical constitutional right second-class status. Without swift correction, the Ninth Circuit's decision will muddle the clear Second Amendment standards this court has adopted and encourage other states to erode Americans' essential right to keep and bear arms. The AGs also do get into the fact that this is just one portion of Hawaii's response to the Bruin decision. They say that Hawaii lawmakers have raised the age to purchase ammunition to 21, required government-issued ID checks for all sales or transfers of ammunition. In 2023, Hawaii lawmakers increased burdensome accountability requirements for the gun industry, allowing individuals, the Attorney General, and local governments to bring civil actions against manufacturers and sellers for harms caused by firearms. State law bans quote-unquote assault pistols, and Hawaii is one of only a handful of states with a may-issue licensing law giving authorities discretion to deny concealed carry licenses even when the applicant satisfies the statutory criteria. So again, it's a good brief. Some of these arguments have been repeated elsewhere, and I'm sure we're going to hear a lot of these oral arguments or a lot of these arguments presented during oral arguments on January the 20th. But that being said, it's good for the court to get hammered with the fact that the Ninth Circuit's decision rests on such flimsy ground. Again, two statutes, and only two statutes, and two statutes that don't actually do what Hawaii's law does. There is no national tradition of banning the carrying of firearms on all private property unless the property owner expressly allows it. There simply isn't. The Ninth Circuit got it wrong. The district court got it right. And I'm not even cautiously optimistic. I'm confident that the court is going to strike down Hawaii's vampire rule. I'm curious as to how far reaching this opinion will be. You know, Bruin dealt with concealed carry of firearms, dealt with specifically the May issue laws in New York that allowed people to be denied their right to carry unless they could justify the reason why they wanted to exercise their Second Amendment rights. But the court did talk about things like sensitive spaces, even though that wasn't directly at an issue or one of the direct issues in Bruin. So the vampire rule is what's being questioned here. But I am hopeful that the court is going to go at least a little above and beyond a very narrow ruling that specifically addresses the vampire rule and nothing else, and will flesh out the test that has to be used. Again, it's got to be more than two statutes written more than 100 years apart. But also, again, flesh out what spaces are and can be considered sensitive. In Bruin, the Supreme Court provided a little bit of guidance. They noted that, legislative bodies, polling places, those were places, schools, I think, were historically places where firearms could be banned. They said that New York City could not declare the entire island of Manhattan a sensitive place simply because it's crowded and there's generally, police around. But that's all we got from the court. And again, given the expansive number of gun-free zones that have been put in place post-Bruin, particularly in blue states, it would not just be good. I think it's necessary for the court to stray a little beyond the question at hand in Wolford and acknowledge that some of these other sensitive places that have been established are not really sensitive at all. That's my hope anyway. Whether or not it happens, remains to be seen. All right. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for a second. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. That's why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag, I'm going to show you my own here. Every bag handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It is designed to look sharp. It is designed to last long. It is designed to tell a story of its own. Each stitch, each buckle, each strap reflects timeless craftsmanship and is backed by a lifetime warranty because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. Whether it's a boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Modern Rugged Leather, modern style, timeless durability, backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. Shop the full collection and find yours today, not mine. You can get one just like it, at modernrugged.com. Again, that is modernrugged.com. All right, now let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of, where was this? Alabama. Man on probation for attempted murder and robbery charged with killing Fairfield teen. So this guy was put on probation just a couple of years ago, actually, even though he got sentenced to 20 years behind bars. 24-year-old Stephen Trainer, now charged with capital murder, accused of murdering 18-year-old Marion Cedric Poole. Back in June, police found a Poole unresponsive in an alley. He was pronounced dead on the scene, 5 o'clock in the afternoon on June 16th. According to local police, community member heard gunfire, saw the victim unresponsive, called 911. Witnesses provided police with a description of a possible shooter who was spotted running from the alley. Trainer was arrested on an unrelated charge a couple of days ago, November 20th. Authorities have not said why the charge against Trainer is capital murder, according to AL.com. But court records show that on October 25th, he pleaded guilty to two counts of attempted murder. discharging a firearm into an occupied dwelling, first-degree robbery, and promoting prison contraband. October 25th of this year, he pleaded guilty to two counts, again, of attempted murder. The crimes to which he pleaded guilty happened in 2021. He received a 20-year sentence with 3 years to serve and was given credit for the 3 years that he had been in the Jefferson County Jail awaiting adjudication of his cases. He was released from jail, put on probation for 5 years. November 21st of this year, he's charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm. And then again, detectives obtaining the capital murder warrant against him. Actually, I guess it must have been 2024, not 2025, because if he had been released from jail in October of 2025, he could not have committed the murder that happened in June of this year. So AL.com, I think, got that wrong. I think he entered his guilty plea October 25th of 2024, which would account for the 3 years behind bars. But again, a 20-year sentence reduced down to three, which essentially was time served for this guy for two counts of attempted murder. I'm gobsmacked about that. I mean, if he had been sentenced to prison, even accounting for a day off your sentence for a day of good behavior, that's 10 years behind bars, right? So he ended up serving less than a third of what he would have likely served had he had to do all 10 years of his 20-year sentence. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And, you know, you got Democrats in Alabama say, oh, we got to have more gun control laws on the books. No, I think we should start with punishing violent offenders with tough sentences instead of essentially what amounts to a get-out-of-jail-free card. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. This is a weird one, by the way. Speaking of cases that are a couple of years old, Kingfisher, Oklahoma, a grand jury has declined to file an indictment against somebody in a 2020 shooting. You know, we talked on this program before about how long it takes sometimes for these cases to get resolved. Well, this case is almost 6 years old. Benjamin Millis never faced charges, by the way. Police and prosecutors originally declined to charge Millis. He was accused, I guess, by others of firing indiscriminately into a crowd of partygoers and killing an individual named Christopher Robinson. This happened back in May of 2020. His attorney said that Benjamin Millis is innocent. We've always known this. He said, we've always maintained that a grand jury was unnecessary. Trained law enforcement officers and prosecutors declined to bring these charges years ago based on substantially the same evidence. But I guess Christopher Robinson's family were able to convene this grand jury. Oklahoma has a process by which a grand jury can be convened via petition. And they got 942 signatures and were able to successfully impanel this grand jury in Kingfisher County to investigate the shooting, alleging that the original investigation, had been mishandled by law enforcement. According to a 2020 police report, Millis said that a third individual named Trevor Gritz had thrown an object at his truck when he passed Gritz's property. That prompted Millis to back up and stop near the property to see what had happened. There was a crowd there on Gritz's property, I guess attending a birthday party. The grand jury petition alleged that Millis had then fired several bullets indiscriminately into a crowd of men attending the party that had gathered near his truck, killing Christopher Robinson. But the grand jury said no. They said this was a chaotic situation. They said witnesses gave accounts that varied on significant points based on their perspective. The report emphasized conflicting testimony about the number of times that Millis had driven past the residence, his speed, whether kids were playing in a ditch near the gravel road where Millis was driving. The report does not dispute that something was thrown at Millis's truck and that it caused confusion, which prompted Millis to stop. But the report found, again, that there was significant disagreement between eyewitnesses about how the group of partygoers approached Millis's car or truck. And witnesses disagreed about how the events proceeded, but all of them, according to the grand jury, described a chaotic scene. The final report from the grand jury said some witnesses recounted several of the male partygoers opening the driver's side front door and attempting to forcibly remove Mr. Millis from his truck. Others are not sure who opened the door and deny that anyone tried to remove Millis from his truck. Inside Millis's truck, his wife, his daughter, he had a friend. And as these people were, you know, going towards his truck, he grabbed his pistol. He warned individuals that he was armed. The grand jury report says one partygoer testified that Mr. Robinson reached into the truck and attempted to take the gun away from Millis as Millis reached in his truck. Another partygoer corroborated that Mr. Robinson grabbed or attempted to grab the gun, which is when Millis fired multiple shots. The grand jury's report says, though the petition alleges that Millis fired indiscriminately towards the partygoers, evidence suggests that Millis fired only at Robinson. We reviewed a frame-by-frame analysis of video that began in the seconds before the fatal shooting. The video confirms that the front driver's door was open, that Mr. Robinson was in a position which would have prevented the door from closing. It also shows the hands of another partygoer inside the back driver's side window of the vehicle at the time of the shooting. There were burn marks near Robinson's gunshot wounds that suggested the shots were fired in close proximity. The final report says, after the shooting, the chaos accelerated to pandemonium, with some partygoers turning their attention to caring for Robinson, others focusing on Millis. The petition that was submitted to the grand jury alleged that Millis began reading a statement on the back of a card related to a concealed carry permit, but the final report said neither video nor testimony corroborates that petitioner's claims. And the jurors believe that Millis had a legitimate stand your ground claim that would have been difficult to overcome for prosecutors if they actually had charged Millis in this shooting. They concluded the report by acknowledging there's a great deal of interest in this case, that 942 of our fellow citizens signed the petition, but they say we understand that some will be greatly disappointed that we did not return any indictments in this matter. Mr. Robinson's death is a tragedy. He was a husband and father. Our job was not to make moral or value judgments about the actions of Mr. Millis. We weren't impaneled to decide whether he did right or wrong. Rather, under our oath, we were constitutionally bound to diligently inquire, gather facts, and consider Oklahoma law. Rest assured, we followed our oath to the best of our collective ability and humbly considered the evidence along with Oklahoma law. Millis's attorney said he hopes that this will finally close this years-long ordeal. He said, we understand that the family and friends of Christopher Robinson will continue to be in pain from losing a loved one. But you've now had a police investigation. You've had prosecutors decline to issue charges. You've had, again, this grand jury impaneled via petition. These grand jurors looked at all of the evidence and, again, concluded that Mr. Millis was acting in self-defense in May of 2020. And like Millis's attorney, yeah, I hope that this is the end of the story of the attempt to charge Mr. Millis with a crime. All right, on to today's good deed of the day. In the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A teen in Hawaii who was in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need. This was this past Saturday. Spencer Allen, who is a senior, 17-year-old senior at Mid-Pacific Institute there in Honolulu. He and a friend were planning on taking his jet ski out. They were going to go to a foiling session when he heard some folks shouting about somebody being lost. And he said, you know, I've been in a situation where we've had to save people, but ever like this. He said it wasn't super rough. It was windy enough to be dangerous. He said the ocean, the tide, the current, and he drifted far from wherever he was. So he's going back and forth in his jet ski for about 10 minutes or so. And he said, I couldn't find anything. So I went super close to the wall so I could hear what they were yelling. And he said, they said a direction. They were pointing. He said, I immediately went that way, and I saw this little black spot. He says it was so tiny, it could have been anything, about a mile out. And it was one of two individuals who were actually swept off their boat. They had a 12-foot boat that sank after it was swamped by a large wave. There was a guy in his 20s who was able to swim to shore, but a guy in his 50s was not. And he was out there until Allen was able to pull him up onto the jet ski and take him to a nearby rescue boat. Spencer Allen said, I was scared. He said, I was tearing up a little bit when I was out on the jet ski. He said, I've never experienced something that scary before. But he had not only foresight, but he had some training. His dad, Tom, is a jet ski operating instructor for Honolulu Ocean Safety. has worked with the Navy SEALs and the Coast Guard. And Alan said, just like all the things my dad taught me, it really worked when it needed to. Said, if I didn't know that, could have gone completely the opposite way. Would have been horrible, but knowing how to get him on the ski safely and where to go was really helpful. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Spencer Allen, who, by the way, is on the U.S. Olympic development team for, I believe, rowing, maybe paddling. I'm not sure, but either way, I know there's somebody in Honolulu who's willing to give him a gold medal right now. And hopefully we'll be hearing more from Spencer Allen in the future. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Again, I want to thank you for being a part of the program. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Rob Doerr, head of the Minnesota Gun Owners Law Center, about the latest local gun control measures in Minnesota. You know, St. Paul has already been sued over its local ordinance banning so-called assault weapons, large-capacity magazines, binary triggers, create a new couple of new gun-free zones. The ordinance says, okay, this isn't going to be enforced until the state gets rid of preemption. But as Rob Doerr has explained, it doesn't work that way. Minnesota's preemption law does not allow for localities to pass gun control laws and then say, well, we're just not going to enforce it. You can't write a gun control ordinance. You can't pass a local gun control ordinance, no matter whether or not it's going to be enforced. You can't do it. And he's been trying to explain this to localities, may have had some success in Edina, Minnesota. City Council wanted to adopt a similar resolution. They're one of, like, I think, like 17 cities around the state that are kind of doing this to put pressure on lawmakers to pass a statewide ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. Edina was slated again to hold a vote next week or last week, but they didn't. The city attorney, the city manager said, well, here's the ordinance that we came up with, but we can't endorse it. Again, because of the preemption law. There were also a lot of critics who have been speaking out to Edina City Council members, to the mayor. So the mayor very reluctantly said, all right, fine, we're going to hold a public hearing. We'll let everybody on both sides, you know, weigh in here. They may end up holding a vote in the future, but for now, Edina has backed off of its local ordinance. That, again, would be clearly preempted by state law. So we'll get an update from Rob on St. Paul, on Edina, and then the other, you know, 15 or so communities that are supposedly still working on their own local ordinances in violation of Minnesota's preemption law. Should be a great conversation. Really looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow as well. I'll be on Newsmax tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern hour, with Carl Higbee. You can check that out. And I would check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, where we are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Just use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. No matter what tier support you choose, you're going to get some great benefits. But I'd love for you to be a VIP Gold or Platinum member so you can hang out with us during our weekly live chat, Wednesdays, 1:30 Eastern, Hot Airs, Ed Morrissey, myself, and our VIP Gold and Platinum members. It's always a great hour. Maybe my favorite hour of the work week. Love for you to be a part of it. Again, use the promo code FIGHT when you go to BearingArms.com/subscribe and sign up for your VIP membership. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.